from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello, and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today, Sharon and I will revisit some recent interviews while we're taking some time off to watch the fireworks.
We'll hear my interview with Mark Zalonis about his long tenure as the IMA's Deputy Director of Environmental Affairs and Historic Preservation.
I'll chat with Hannah Lindgren about her documentary film, Food First.
And I'll hear about 19 Stars of Indiana Art, the Indianapolis Museum of Art's tribute to our bicentennial. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. For nearly two decades, Mark Zalonis served as the Ruth Lilly Deputy Director of Environmental and Historic Preservation for the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Mark has recently retired from that position, and Sharon Gamble invited him in to learn what he's most proud of and what his next chapter is.
Before we talk about your couple of decades, almost two decades at the IMA, I want to talk about how you got started on this career path in the first place. When you were growing up, did you know about preservation, conservation?
If I did, it wasn't in that context. It was just sort of what I did and what my dad and my brothers and others did around the house and around the yard. But it was, if I can attribute it to anything, it was probably my father, who of all the five sons that he had and two daughters, I was the one who spent the most time in the garden fixing up things around the house, but primarily in the garden. And then some other influence from my grandmother, who whenever I picked her up to take her to church on Sunday morning, she would take me out into her garden and show me what was in bloom. So it wasn't any direct action on my part. It was just what came to me because that's what I like to do. And then later on when I went to undergraduate school and—
Which was where? Where'd you go?
Northeastern University to start with as a mathematics major.
Oh, really?
And after a year, I said, what in the world am I doing this for? All I could see in my future was teaching, and I really didn't think that was where I should be. So I transferred to the University of New Hampshire, and just by taking an elective course in botany, actually in dendrology or taxonomy, learning the names of plants that were on the campus and in the college woods, I said, boy, this really would be fun. So I sort of changed direction, ended up in what was then called plant science, now called horticulture. But I went through that program and went on my way to do an internship at the Arnold Arboretum in Boston, which was a great first step, and then found my way to the Peace Corps after college.
Did you really?
In Liberia, West Africa, where I met my wife of now 43-plus years.
Wow.
And that gave me a good background in growing things, particularly coffee and cocoa, which is a lot of fun. And from there, the day after I got back from West Africa, I had a call from my former professor saying, boy, there's a job opening at a place called Fuller Gardens in right on the seacoast of New Hampshire, and would you be interested in applying for it? And I did, and I got the job and was there for a good 9 years before deciding to go back to graduate school.
And so that was 9 years was the equivalent of another hands-on degree, really.
It really was, and it was a smallish place, a former estate of Governor Alvin T. Fuller of Massachusetts, back when a governor could live outside the state, live in an adjoining state for his summer months. But it was a great place to learn all the things I needed to learn about not only horticulture, but managing people and budgets and all that sort of thing.
And what the whole not-for-profit world is like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it was just a beautiful place with views of the ocean. We could hear the ocean lapping on the rocks at night. It was just a beautiful spot. So it was tough to pull away and go to graduate school.
What made you decide you needed to go back to school?
I think I needed a bit more training, particularly in management skills and just working with a larger group of people. Fuller Gardens was small enough that it was myself and one other year-round person, but a half a dozen seasonal people that came in for the summer months. And I just thought I needed the chance to work with a larger group of people. So I went to the University of Delaware in its Longwood Graduate Program in Public Horticulture Administration, but also got a Museum Studies certificate. So worked with other folks who were in their Museum Studies area to learn all the basic administrative and financial skills that were necessary for a greater position. And when I got through there, there was a position open at a place in Rhode Island called Blythewold, which is another former private estate turned public, again, right on salt water. So I was very fortunate to have about 1,000 foot long shoreline to deal with 33 acres of spectacular trees and shrubs and plants, but also a historic house, 44 room house that I managed, and just had a great time not only working there but living there. We lived in the former staff quarters in the mansion.
Oh, fun.
And was there for 14 years before deciding to come out here to Indiana.
And what appealed to you about this job, this place?
Well, I had, with great fortune, had visited it just a year and a half beforehand. I was asked to come out and address the Horticultural Society at the IMA to give a talk about gardens in New England. I was invited by Chuck Gleaves, who was my predecessor at the IMA. And a year later, when he decided to leave the IMA to go on to Kingwood Center in Ohio, he called and said, gee, would you be interested in taking my place? And if I had not come out here that year before, I probably would not have given it much thought. But I liked what I saw in Indiana. I enjoyed seeing the museum and its gardens. And so within a couple of days, I was out here talking with Brett Waller, who was the director at the time, and was intrigued by not only what was happening there on the property, but what could be happening. We talked about restoring some of the gardens that had not yet been uncovered and restored, but also the Lily House or Oldfields had a chance to work on that very directly. And then, very importantly, the what is now the Virginia B. Fairbanks Art and Nature Park, which was really in its very, very rough state back then in the late 1990s.
That had a long gestation then.
A long gestation. It was in Brett's mind for many years as to what could happen out there. And I said, boy, if we can work on this, if we had the funds to do it, we could really make something very significant of it. And luckily, funds did come largely through the Fairbanks Foundation to make it happen. So all of those things made it intriguing to come out and manage an even larger property with a larger staff, and have just grew into it, I think, with the great support of the museum, but in particular the Horticultural Society, which has grown now to be the largest affiliate group of the museum.
I'm very pleased.
It really is. So I'm very happy about that with all the other art venues that could be the largest. But anyway, we're very happy about that. So that group in particular or in general, but also a lot of individuals who gave support, financial and just encouragement over the years to make happen what has happened over the past 18 years or so.
It's a little unusual. I mean, it's not unique, but a little unusual to have an art museum on a campus that had been a private estate.
Right, right. It's a very unusual situation. I don't know of too many, if any, that are exactly like this. The IMA has the great chance to exhibit both that historic landscape that was part of the Oldfields property, but also the new, more contemporary gardens and landscape that are in front of the museum building itself. So there are two very different styles that allow us to present horticulture in many different ways and talk about the changing styles of landscape design. And then with the new Art and Nature Park, you had plants in a very natural setting along the White River. And then most recently with the addition of the Miller House down in Columbus, with another spectacular landscape by probably one of the most important landscape designers of the 20th century, Dan Kiley.
And it was one of his favorites.
It was, I think, his favorite. He admitted it was his best work, and it remains his best work. Having seen just about everything that he has designed, it's certainly in the best shape of anything that he worked on for a good 60 years or so. So the museum is really exemplary in having that landscape plus landscapes at the IMA that were done by the Olmsted brothers. There's elements of a Jensen landscape over at the director's residence. And then many other very well-known landscape designers have worked on the museum property. And that's one of the neatest things about having been there. And I know the staff and my new successor, Jonathan Wright, are really in a great position to not only take care of these types of gardens, but to share them with the public.
So take us behind the scenes, because it's one thing to restore a building to how it was when it was built, you know, repairing plaster or tuck pointing or whatever. But a historic landscape, do most landscape architects or designers leave instructions for what's to happen in the future? Because plant materials don't last forever.
Exactly.
So how does that work?
That's a good point. Unfortunately, they don't always leave instructions or a care book. About the only one who did that I know of who was very explicit was Beatrix Farrand, whose probably most famous work is Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C. And she actually left a manual that said in 15 years these shrubs are going to be at the maturity.
Do this,
take it out, cut it back to the ground or whatever. And that's the only real area or garden that I know of that has been as explicit as that. At the very beginning at the IMA, I had some of our staff people, as we were restoring the ravine garden that with help from the Rapp family, we started to establish a notebook so that whenever anything was replaced or cut back, you know, substantially, that was recorded, so that whoever takes over in the future will know that in 2002 this was removed and something else put in, and here's the reason why it went from this species or this cultivar to another one. You know, there was problems with its availability or had disease problems, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because that's the other issue. Sometimes, especially if you're dealing with a landscape that was designed decades ago, we might discover that something has all sorts of
Issues,
yeah.
Right. As an example.
It becomes invasive, or it just succumbs to mildew every year or whatever.
Right. Some of the plants that were called for by Percival Gallagher back in 1920 included some honeysuckles, which are either not available now or have become a nuisance in the garden. Barberries were another thing that were just commonly suggested at the time, and we now know that these are not great things to have in the landscape. So we've made some very careful choices, but we've always documented what those choices are so that somebody long after me or my staff would know, okay, that's why they did that. And so we're hoping that people will learn in the future why we did those things.
What a great opportunity to be part of that stewardship.
Oh, yeah. And that's I'm glad you brought that term up, because stewardship is really what this all is. We, you know, by and large, we did not create that landscape that is there. The newer parts, maybe we had a greater hand in it. But I've always thought that we're stewards along the way. There'll be another group coming in after me and so forth down the line. And it's really a great responsibility to steward that property to the future. And as you know, the landscapes change day by day, even not just month by month, but day by day. And a storm can come in and radically change the landscape, or just over time, things grow and outgrow their spots, and you have to make some changes. So it's important to think of it as a long, long journey.
Not just this lifetime.
Right, right. Yeah. So it's a very slow progressing work of art. It's a work of art in many, many different ways. But the nice thing, and I think for our visitors' sake, is that it does change. Unlike a work of art hanging on a wall, which looks the same now as it did 100 years ago or will 100 years ago or 100 years from now, the landscape is forever changing. And to me, that's the exciting part of it.
Speaking of changing landscapes, what's your next horizon?
My next horizon. Actually, it's since retiring a couple of months ago, I've been as busy as ever with a number of things. Some lecturing, some advisory consulting that I've been doing with a number of groups. Matter of fact, next week I go to New York City for a board meeting for the Library of American Landscape History, on whose board I've been active for about 10 years or so. And this is a group that publishes books on American landscape history, and they have maybe 24 volumes to their credit right now and more in the works, including one on Dan Kiley in the work at the Miller House. So I continue to work on that.
You're developing some travel opportunities,
yes,
right?
Yes, travel as well. I've started a new element that at least temporarily is called cultural excursions. And I'm working with a local tour operator, Interlude Tours, and putting together tours around the property, just as I had done for the museum for the past 18 years. And I'm happy to say, as of this morning, our first trip that we're planning to southeastern New England is sold out, starting a wait list for that.
Wow.
And taking suggestions from people as to where they might like to go, either around the country or even overseas. I'm talking with some folks about some possible overseas journeys and things. So it's keeping me busy for sure. And it keeps me active in the field, utilizing my contacts and with colleagues really around the country who know me and are happy to share their properties. That's the nice thing about horticultural folks or people in the historic house business is they love to showcase what they have. So it occupies a good deal of my time and keeps me in contact with a lot of those folks, but also keeps me in contact with some of the travelers that have been active with me over the past 18 years. So it's just a nice way to keep me involved with them, but also with the world of horticulture and historic preservation in general.
Sharon Gamble with Mark Zelonis, the newly retired Ruth Lilly, Deputy Director of Environmental and Historic Preservation at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. You can learn more about cultural excursions travel at mark.zelonis@att.net. Again, that's mark.zelonis, Z-E-L-O-N-I-S, @att.net. Or you can give a call to 258-2071. Again, 317-258-2071.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Years ago, the phrase farm to table was just being used by a few hardcore foodies. Today, it seems to be everywhere. The new feature documentary Food First looks at how the nationwide food movement is impacting Indianapolis. Travis DiNicola spoke with filmmaker Hannah Myers Lindgren about the movie.
Hannah, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So am I. I'm really impressed by what I've seen of this film so far. And we're going to talk about the film in just a minute and sort of how it came to be. But I first became aware of your work a couple of years ago when I saw a documentary you had created about fans of John Green, the Nerd Fighters. And that was a great piece.
Thank you.
But the quality of this new one, Food First, is just outstanding.
Thank you. Yeah, it's definitely on a different different caliber. I produced the Nerd Fighters documentary when I was in school, and about 75% of that content was crowdsourced from the community. So depending on whatever the community had access to in terms of camera and audio, that's what we got.
Right. It was kind of a mix.
This one's a little bit different in that it's the first film that I've produced with my production company. So it's a lot more consistent in terms of style and quality overall.
So which came first here, the working on the film or the production company that you've started?
The production company. Mm-hmm. So I started that pretty much right out of school in 2013, in June of 2013. And from there, I mostly did client work. We still mostly do client work.
And it's deliberate media.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Deliberate Media. Mm-hmm. And for a while it was just me, but fortunately last year I was able to hire someone full time, so now mm-hmm. we're kind of a duo.
Cool.
But yeah, we started that in 2013, and then we started producing this film in spring of 2014. So it was they're almost about the same age, but the production company is a little bit older.
So why is it that you wanted to produce this film? I mean, you have a very personal connection to food.
Yes, I
mean,
do.
I guess we all do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all, that's the whole point of the film, mm-hmm. is that food is very important to all of us. But yeah, I've had a evolving relationship with food. When I was a freshman in college, I got very, very ill, to the point where it was hard for me to get out of bed and go to class because I wasn't able to consume the nutrients that I needed, and I was just so weak and tired and it just was losing weight very rapidly. So, you know, had a series of doctor's appointments.
Most
and
people
tests.
Get the freshman 10 or 15 or whatever, right?
Well, I got that, and then I quickly lost it as I got sick. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we figured out that it was all related to my digestive system, and that I had several different food intolerances, and it had created leaky gut in my digestive system. So from there, it was just a process of healing and recovery. I had to have a couple other things done, like my mm-hmm. gallbladder removed. And slowly over the years, I originally saw it as a thing to just be angry about.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very bitter. And
frustrated, I'm sure.
Very frustrated. Yeah. I got overwhelmed very easily, like if I had to go out to eat, or I didn't really enjoy cooking at that time, so much to my mother's dismay. So I wouldn't know really what to do, and I felt overwhelmed. But then when I got out of school and I was living on my own, I realized that it was entirely my own power of what I put into my mouth and what I put into my body. I was responsible.
No longer relying on dorm food.
No, not relying on dorm food. Yeah, or mm-hmm. mom. And so then I started going to farmers markets and learning more about fresh food and how to cook it. And it's been a process. I mean, it's not easy to learn how to, you know, cook your own food and what your body needs and everything, but it's been just wonderful and educating, and that's my journey has just grown exponentially since I started this film.
So how did that turn into the film? I mean, at what point did you say, wait a second, I'm not just learning about food for myself, but I want to make a documentary about this?
Yeah, so at first I thought about making it like a personal documentary about mm-hmm. my own story, about my own sort of coming to terms with food. But then I realized that the food story in itself of what's going on here in Indy is much more powerful than my own. And it expands much beyond health and everything. It's on social services and economy and that sort of thing. And so once I got introduced to one person, it just led to the next, to the next. And then I realized how multifaceted the community really was.
You really feature some interesting people in the film. A number of people who I know, and I'm sure our listeners will recognize, Dr. Lisa Harris from Eskenazi, Laura and Tyler Henderson from Growing Places Indy, R.J. Wall, the founder of Chef's Night Off Indy, Ted Grain from LISC. A lot of really interesting people that are included in this, as well as other people involved with things like green bean delivery and different chefs, of course. How'd you go about getting all these people involved?
Yeah, well, so my journey kind of started with a chance meeting with Chef Wendell Fowler, who is a personality on Wish TV.
Mm-hmm.
And he introduced me to Audrey Barron, who at that time was just starting construction on Ezra's Enlightened Cafe, the first raw vegan cafe in Indy. So from Audrey, I just sort of started following her, and then she led me to, you know, growers and agriculture, and she led me to other restaurant owners, and it really just rippled out from there. And what's cool is all these people, yes, you'd think, oh, they all have food in common. That's very true. But they are very different things. You know, they all tackle very different things related to food. But when in the film, you'll see that even though they're all different topics and they were interviewed about whatever topic that they specialized in, mm-hmm. they really create one cohesive voice that represents what the food movement is all about.
For example, I mentioned Dr. Lisa Harris and Eskenazi. Of course, they have the rooftop garden there mm-hmm. Where they actually grow food.
The
and
sky farm,
that's
yep.
the connection back to food, of course, and obviously food and health.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely one facet of it. But then what's also great is each person, place, individual, business that we featured tended to have kind of like 1 foot here, 1 foot there. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, you'd think, oh yeah, you know, Eskenazi, the hospital, the Sky Farm, they're all about wellness and health and stuff. And they are, but also they specifically have their clinics, you know, in neighborhoods where people are underserved, and they're in food deserts, and they're in places where people don't have access. And they serve people even if they can't afford to, you know, have medical care. They still do that. And so that brings in the social services aspect, which then, you know, brings in LISC and brings in what they're doing to try and growing places indie, you know, in education. And it just really, it's a giant web. It's all interconnected.
Yeah. LISC, the local initiative support group. I mean, I sort of think of them more as, you know, neighborhood development. And so at first I'm like, oh, what's Ted doing in this food documentary, right?
Yeah. And, you know, Ted is actually throughout the entire film. I don't think he expected that. but he just managed to really cement all the pieces together and really show how it all is interconnected. And I really like in the film, he describes it as there's all these different pillars of the food movement, right? There's, you know, the people who care about sustainability, there's the people who care about wellness, there's people who care about restaurants, and then access and education. Well, the thing that is really creating a huge movement in Indianapolis right now is that all of the pillars are starting to talk to each other and realizing that with each other, they are stronger. And they, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. If everyone is working together and working cohesively, it's just going to get better and better for everyone.
So what did you learn during the course of making this documentary?
So much. On a personal level, I just learned a lot more about, you know, feeding my body with the things that it needs. And it's made me, you know, feel much better than I have in the 6 years since I've gotten sick. So that has been a wonderful personal addition to my life. But on another level, I just, you know, I fell even more in love with Indianapolis. This is a fantastic place. And the more that you learn about what's going on with this community and this movement, the more amazing it is. And you just, you start to be like, wow, Indianapolis is really doing some fantastic things. I showed this to a friend who's, you know, she's from the South, she's from Birmingham and stuff. And she said, I didn't realize Indianapolis was so progressive. And I was like, yeah, no one does. That's the point. And that's what we want to do with this film, is tell everyone what's happening here, because it's really cool.
It is very cool. So, I mean, that's obviously one thing you want people to get out of this, and just to like recognize that there's some really cool things going on in the food movement here. What else do you hope people get out of this, being able to see this documentary?
I hope they get out of it whatever they need. So, you know, obviously, it would be really great if people saw the film and said, I really want to get engaged in the food community in this way, whether that's volunteering with Growing Places Indie, or whether that's deciding that the one night a week they go out to eat, they're going to only eat local, or, you know, deciding, oh, I'm going to try and get as much of my food from the farmer's market as possible. You know, it's a small, tiny thing that you can do to change, you know, or it's a big thing. You can decide that that's, you know, that you want to focus more on this. Our intern right now, she watched the film and she's like, this is incredible. Like, I didn't realize it. And I'm just feel very passionate right now. Like, I need to get involved in this. And that's what it's all about, is the more people we can have talking about it, the better.
So let's talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of how the film got made. Because it was really through a Kickstarter campaign, right?
Sort of, yeah.
You're part of that?
Yeah. Okay. We, in order to get kind of the initial funding, because my business was less than a year old when we decided to start this, we didn't really have a whole lot of funds stored up. So we did an initial Kickstarter campaign where we got about $3,000 to start. And that just helped us with some equipment needs that we still needed, some time, so labor from additional people, because at that time it was only me. And so it was a lot harder to get shoots done. And there we, you know, we quickly exhausted that. And really over the last year and a half, it's just been, you know, Deliberate Media funds, our client work that's been funding this.
So it's not like the different, food places that are featured in this are sponsors in any way or anything.
No, not until right now at the very end when we said, you know, we're doing this final push. There's a ton of costs here at the end. And we put a call out for sponsors, and Visit Indy and Indy Food Council both sponsored us a little bit. So that was fantastic. And it gave us a little bit of extra, you know, room to get some of those things. Because, you know, before we were just doing things that were our own labor. So it didn't really cost us anything but time. Whereas now, you know, we had to send it off to a sound editor, to a color corrector, to a graphics person, and all those individuals cost more money up front.
Sure, of course. So how can people see this?
Yeah, so we're having a six screening series this summer over June and July. There's four in June and two in July. And the premiere will be at Tyner Pond Farm on Saturday, June 11th at 5 o'clock. And each screening is really unique because each one of them is followed by a community conversation. So obviously we cannot include everything that's happening in the food scene in our documentary because it would be like a week-long documentary. So we had to figure out a way to continue the discussion and include businesses and organizations that we were not able to include.
I see.
So, you know, we featured these certain ones in the film, but from there we're partnering with other organizations and businesses on the ground to host these screenings. And then afterwards, have panelists that are comprised of people doing similar work or other types of things that, you know, support other areas of the food movement. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a discussion about it.
And each screening will then have a different theme.
Yeah. Each screening is a different theme. Yeah. For five of them, they're very much, you know, this one's about access, this one's about nutrition, that sort of thing. The only one that's different is our one up in Hamilton County, because that's where our production company is. We're doing that discussion about what's happening in Hamilton County.
Sure, that makes sense.
So, yeah.
So any plans for larger distribution or what happens next?
Yes. Well,
you've been working on this a long time. I know you want to get it out there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and then the biggest thing is, you know, we want the discussion to be here and we want people here to learn about it and engage in it, but we also want to show other people. I mean, just like my friend that I mentioned who didn't realize Indy was so progressive, well, that's what we want to do, is spread the word about it. So we actually on Friday applied to our first seven film festivals, and we're going to continue doing them in kind of batches for the rest of the year. And hopefully, you know, we're doing some food themed ones and then some ones around the Midwest, and we're just hoping to get as many eyes on it as possible.
Well, you have to keep us updated on that.
I will.
And let us know. Excellent. Well, looking forward to seeing the entire documentary, Food First. Hannah, thanks so much for coming in to Art of the Matter. It's great to have you here. And congratulations on an amazing film.
Oh, thank you so much.
Travis DiNicola with filmmaker Hannah Myers Lindgren of Deliberate Media. You can get the full schedule and preview the film at DeliberateMediaLLC.com/Food First. Once again, DeliberateMediaLLC.com/food-first. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Do we have any watermelon left over from our 4th of July party the other day?
Oh, if we do, we can make pickled watermelon rinds.
I love pickled watermelon rind. Yummy. Well, we have lots of fresh things, no leftovers on our calendar, we call.
What'll we do? Nicely done. Hey, it is the last weekend for the 50th Indianapolis Early Music Festival going on this weekend.
Already?
And I know, it's been going
so fast.
Friday, July 8th, 7:30, The Folly of Youth is being performed, including the vocal music of Handel. And then on Sunday, July 10th at 4 o'clock, the winners of the International Indianapolis Baroque Competition will be performing as well. All the concerts are at the Indiana History Center on Ohio Street, and this wraps up the 50th Indianapolis Early Music Festival this weekend.
Wow. Hey, I have something coming up next Thursday night on Bastille Day, July 14th. So if you're not going to a Bastille party, or even if you are, I want you to consider putting this on your calendar. It's called Love Wins. Jim Obergefell is appearing at Indie Reads as part of a book launch. And it is about his book celebrating the U.S. Supreme Court case Obergefell versus Hodges regarding marriage equality. The full title of the book is Love Wins, The Lovers and Lawyers Who Fought the Landmark Case for Marriage Equality. And that event is Thursday, July 14th, 5:30 to 7. You can learn lots more at IndyReadsBooks.org. Easy for me to say, IndyReadsBooks.org.
Hey, next week is the ISO at Ellenberger Park. It's their annual Symphony in the Park free
near
concert.
You.
Yeah. Wednesday, July 13th, 7:30. Vince Lee is the conductor. And these are just such great concerts when they perform at the park. And this year, they're going to be doing some Verdi and some Brahms, as well as some famous movie hits from John Williams, including Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Wars, and Superman, and other stuff. And Ellenberger Park is just a beautiful, beautiful park in Irvington. And so this should be a great concert to check out. Wednesday at 7:30.
Running this weekend through July 17th, various times and locations, it is the annual Indiana Black Expo's summer celebration, bringing events for all ages and interests throughout primarily the downtown area, including Indiana Convention Center, American Legion Mall, Bankers Life Fieldhouse, and more, more, more. So check that out online, Indiana Black Expo's summer celebration.
It is not too early to start thinking about Fringe, which of course takes place in August, and the kickoff of Fringe every year is the longest dinner, and this year it's going to be on Tuesday, August 2nd, and it is a huge dinner where they make a really, really, really one long table that they set up in the alley and garden by the Indy Fringe Basile Theater, and three-course dinner and champagne and wine and beer and music and Fringe entertainment, and it always sells out, so if you're thinking about it, get your tickets now.
I have in my hand a sassy postcard for Scavenge the Avenue, the fundraising event for Indie Reads, which is coming up on July 20th. The man and the woman on the postcard have these really groovy, what do I call that?
Steampunk, Sharon.
Steampunk, that's it. I looked at that and I said, they've got steampunk goggles on. That will help them scavenge the avenue. What is it? Well, it's a scavenger hunt. You can do it by yourself or with a team. Learn more at indiereads.org. And it's tons and tons of fun things to see and do and eat and drink along the way as well.
Up and down Mass Ave.
You got
well,
it.
You can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Arts Guide website, or listen to us next week on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
"19 Stars of Indiana Art" is the Indianapolis Museum of Art's tribute to our bicentennial. The exhibit will take visitors through 200 years of our state's visual art and present the accomplishments of 19 artists who were born in Indiana, such as T.C. Steele, Robert Indiana, Michael Graves, and Bill Blass, along with many other artists who were raised or worked in Indiana. Sharon Gamble invited Dr. Annette Schlagenhoff, curator of special projects, and Anna Stein, curatorial assistant, to tell us more about this multimedia celebration.
So, Annette, tell me about the conversation where somebody said, well, you know, we have this bicentennial coming. How are we going to celebrate?
Well, celebrate was the key word here. And probably about 2.5 years ago, we all sat down around a table and tried to bat around a few ideas. And a number of people had good ideas. The one that this show will treat is an exhibition that we've called 19 Stars of Indiana Art, based off the concept that our state flag has 19 stars, and we want to turn 19 artists into the stars of Indiana.
Fantastic. So in the process of compiling that list of 19, you probably came up with a lot more, and you had to weed it out.
We did do a lot of weeding,
yeah.
And there were some criterion for that. If you're going to pick 19, you want to have sort of a good depth in each of those.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them, when we compiled a really large list, some of them fell by the wayside because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And others came up. And we knew that we wanted to do it with our permanent collection so that we weren't going to be borrowing things, because our permanent collection is pretty strong. Curators have built that collection, always focusing on the Indiana connection.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a chance to pick some where we had good depth. And then we wanted to make it as diverse as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, photography, prints and drawings, paintings, fashion arts, all of those areas where Indiana artists or artists with Indiana connections really excelled.
That's a good – I'm glad you rephrased that, because they aren't all necessarily from here. Some of them were raised here. Some of them were born here and moved away.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, like Halston, for example, was born in Iowa, but he grew up in Evansville.
Mm-hmm.
And he maintained a really strong connection to Evansville for his entire life. Or somebody that Anna can talk about a little bit more, Wilhelmina Siegmiller.
Was originally a Canadian and made her home in Indianapolis.
What and brought her here?
She was an educator, and she came to the United States for part of her professional training and then moved around to a couple different cities in the United States. Unfortunately, there's not a lot known about her, so this exhibition has been a great opportunity for us to dig in a little bit more to this interesting individual who was really a leader in art education in her time. And she was based right here in Indianapolis.
And what, she was a hands-on artist as well?
She did also make art, yes. So she made prints that were inspired by Japanese prints, which was a very popular thing to do at the time.
What's her ish? Turn of the last century?
Yeah, she was early 20th century, okay. So the 19-teens.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did printmaking, and then she incorporated those prints into her educational material. She wrote books to use in the classroom. She wrote books of poetry.
Wow.
And then she illustrated them herself. So she,
and we'd like to make Siegmiller or a household name by the time the show closes.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
When you were thinking about sort of diversity, were you also thinking about trying to be sort of equally representative of, like, have somebody from every decade of our 200 years, or at least try to have the span of 200 years pretty well, pretty much.
Yeah. The first gallery that you'll go into has sort of a timeline that divides the 200 years into five periods. And we did want to, you know, make sure that there were representative figures for each of those periods.
Are those periods named?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Well, I'm intrigued.
We created some of the names. Some
sure.
of them are very obvious. But the first one is the Frontier Years. Indiana's Golden Age is the second one, and those are terms that are frequently used. Then we call the period from 1920 to 1959 through uncertain times. We've got the Depression and World War II.
Sure.
The turbulent 60s, you know, stand out. And then the last one that goes from 1970 to today we call the Road to Now.
Okay. Okay.
So each of those has a diversity of artists. We made a distinct effort to include women
mm-hmm.
and African American artists who
mm-hmm.
are generally underrepresented,
mm-hmm.
You know, in exhibitions. So, you know, that alongside with the diversity in the type of art that they made
mm-hmm.
really sort of drove this project.
Right. I'm curious. This is kind of a big assumption here, but is there any commonality that you found in looking at all of these pieces, and you said, if I weren't from here, mm-hmm. I would know that the state of Indiana had an influence on this artist, that artist, or the other artist?
We struggled with that a little bit. I mean, I think that the commonality is, and I'm still bowled over by this, is just the desire to be creative. It is there so strongly. And when we were thinking about, you know, 19 artists, because the state flag has 19 stars, we realize 19 is a hard number to sort of wrap your head around when
mm-hmm.
you're one by one, you know, you're sort of marching these artists. So what we ended up doing was grouping them into five categories that sort of, in a way, celebrate a little bit of what, you know, we've come to call the Hoosier spirit. So we divide them into categories that are not chronological in any way, but pioneers and innovators, entrepreneurs, nature lovers, teachers and trainers, and visionaries and dreamers.
Hmm.
And by doing that, you know, you'll get some artists like someone like Jacob Cox, who was a pioneer artist.
He was literally a pioneer in that he was one of the first professional artists in Indiana when we were still a pioneering state in the 1830s and 40s.
And then we link, you know, in that gallery, we link him with somebody like Halston, who was definitely a big pioneer. So it just spans big.
Wow, that, I love that because that, you know, fires new neurons for the visitors who are like, whoa, I would never think of those two in the same breath. But
right, like is not with like in this show.
Fun. So, good for you. Yeah.
It's a good way to unite this great diversity of artists.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have all kinds of activities. I'm intrigued by the scavenger hunt that you've come up with. Tell me about that.
So we're doing an activity called Follow the Stars, based on, of course, these 19 stars. And obviously, we've pulled 19 of our favorite Indiana-related artists into this exhibition, but there's plenty of other art in the museum and around the campus that was also made by artists who were inspired by Indiana or had lived in Indiana or had some sort of connection to Indiana. And so we wanted to highlight those. And so we're creating an activity that encourages you to find these objects that are going to be marked around the campus or in the museum, especially, of course, in our American collection. And we are encouraging guests to find those. They'll be marked with a star, and you are encouraged to sort of snap a selfie with your favorite one.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. And there'll be maybe a place on your website where people can share their selfies down the road, maybe?
We're using a hashtag for social media
sharing.
Sure, of
course.
Called IMA Follow the Stars.
Yeah.
And we're going to, I think the plan is to have also a screen in the entrance pavilion that rolls through a number of the selfies that people take so that you can see what guests in the museum are doing. And that way we can sort of see everybody following the stars on the IMA campus.
That's fun. Tell me about, you're also doing kind of crowdsourcing a landscape. What is this about?
It's called Inspired by Indiana, and in that gallery that's devoted to nature lovers, there is an activity space that's been designed by the educators at the museum, and there is sort of a linear drawing of a landscape, and then parents with their kids can start making a number of objects and then adding it to that landscape.
Aww.
So you can follow models and maybe make the state insect, which has just been made the state insect, the Say's firefly, or you make the state flower, the peony, or the state bird, which is the cardinal, and add it to the landscape. Or you can just be creative and make whatever you want and put it up there and also snap a selfie. And
detecting a theme
send
here.
Yeah.
Accessibility is very important. So I have the feeling that in your roles as curators that you can't really have favorites because every new artist you look into you probably fall in love with a little bit because each one is fascinating. But do you have favorites as you went through and put this exhibition together?
I know I do.
All right. Tell us.
It's one of the last things in the exhibition too, although a little bit's featured in the front. There's a printmaker named William Majors who we're featuring in the Visionaries and Dreamers section. And he does these really beautiful etchings that have fantastic texture. They're abstract, but they really reward close looking. And you can sort of just get absorbed into admiring all of this beautiful, beautiful detail, this rich detail in these prints.
He's contemporary? He's alive
He has passed away. He worked in the 60s, 70s mm-hmm. is sort of the peak of his career.
And how did he train? Because printmaking, you know, is still, I'm reflecting a little bit on your recently closed Gustav Bauman mm-hmm. exhibition that printmaking is so specialized, mm-hmm. and for somebody to have been doing it that recently, did he go to Japan or Germany?
Oh, no. He did a little bit of study abroad in Italy, but only for sort of inspirational factors. He was inspired mm-hmm. by religious art in Italy, even though he did more abstract work. He was inspired by many traditional elements. But he did study a little bit at the Heron School of Art here with another printmaker in our show, Gero Antresian, mm-hmm. who was a fantastic printmaker, and you'll see some of his work as well. But he ended up, William Majors ended up on the New York art scene in the end, and that's mm-hmm. where he did most of his printmaking.
Fun. So,
but he's an original Indianapolis native.
Local boy makes good.
Yes.
Annette, some of your favorites?
Well, I've always been a major David Smith fan. I mean, for 20th century sculpture, I mean, he broke so many of the barriers. And I learned a lot more about him as well, but I think the revelation for me was really George Rickey, whom I knew a little bit less about. And we have this wonderful piece in the show that he actually made when he was teaching on the art faculty at IU Bloomington. And it has a crazy long title called No Cybernetic Exit.
Yes, that was in some of your media materials. I wanted to understand that.
Yeah, and this was early in his career. He had trained as a painter, and so he came to making kinetic art later in life. And he befriended a faculty member who was a statistician in the economics department at IU Bloomington, who published all his papers on the bituminous coal industry and labor disputes.
Someone has to.
Someone has to, right. And so they must have befriended each other, and this professor asked Ricky to make a sculpture. So Ricky looked at all the papers that his friend had written and saw all these graphs and charts in the paper. And so this is sort of a three-dimensional version of some of those graphs and charts. So I think that was one thing we discovered in sort of digging around in the files.
There's a lesson in there. If you're an artist, don't just hang out with other artists.
That's right.
I think so. Yeah.
Inspired by anything.
And exactly. Ricky certainly had an interest in math and science. So he was kind of a numbers guy himself. So he gravitated that direction a little bit.
Sharon Gamble with the IMA's Dr. Annette Schlagenhoff, Curator of Special Projects, and Anna Stein, Curatorial Assistant. 19 Stars of Indiana opens May 15th and runs through January 8th. It includes paintings, prints, photographs, sculpture, fashion design, and other works from the IMA's permanent collection. 19 Stars is just one of the IMA's bicentennial celebrations. You can learn more at imamuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out what the Cabaret has planned for this coming season.
I'll talk with the director and the teenage star of Summer Stock Stage's Shrek the Musical.
Nice. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What do we do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.